Welcome to a very special episode of the Behavioral Design Podcast. Me and Aline, we're going to do something different. We're going to dig into some questions that haven't been explored so far, and also some questions that we haven't ourselves explored. So Aline, are you excited to do this end of year special?
Oh, I'm so excited. I mean, I love having our guests on, but sometimes it's fun to just do our little, fireside chat between the two of us.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And I think we don't know what we're going to say, right? But we have some topics planned for this discussion, and they're all very interesting topics, including what are the biggest opportunities to improve behavioral science within? Should a behavioral scientist be happy as well? Is that something? As we mentioned, what have we learned from the pandemic? What have we changed our mind about? And much, much more. So any last thoughts or words before we get started?
No, let's dive in. I've been waiting for so long to ask you. We've asked all our guests about what they've learned about human behavior in the pandemic. And we've heard all of their answers. And I think as a result, had basically a year to think about, what are our opinions on this and what's your version. So I'm curious, Sam, what is an unexpected thing that you've learned about human behavior from the pandemic?
Okay. So I obviously knew this question was going to come up, thought a lot about it. And in some ways, my answer is not super surprising, but I don't think it's actually been much discussed in the season so far. Mm. And for me, I am so fascinated with COVID deniers or anti-vax movement. Mm-hmm. I think that is such an interesting little mini case study of its own. And just this week, there was a clip in Sweden that went viral from this kind of anti-vax proponent, where it was so well done from a behavioral standpoint. They did it so, so well. So it was kind of like this thing where you have this Swedish woman filming herself kind of with this casual mobile view kind of thing. She looks like just a concerned citizen and details things, just throws out a lot of statistics that are in some way true, but doesn't paint the whole picture. And so you're just painting this very one-sided picture of statistics and asking these, questions like, what do you think? Should the government be more transparent? What do you think? Should we really trust these companies to do the right thing?
some really leading questions.
Yeah. I feel like it's almost a virus in itself, the whole idea is that the viruses mutate. Sadly, we have had these variants, right? They improve. And I feel like that's really what I've seen within this anti-vax movement, is that they find ways to continuously creep in with doubt and with these quite well-made campaigns to really plant the vision and so on. And where there could be some good debates on, for example, mandates, I think that's definitely something we can definitely discuss. There's nothing wrong with discussing the good or bad with mandates or mask or anything like that. I think it just becomes very extreme.
Yeah, it's not an even-handed discussion. As it's presented as one, but it's not actually. Very sad.
It's quite odd. I agree. And and it's sad, obviously, to see the lack of vaccine uptake in countries where you have a lot of availability and access to them.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I think has been most heartbreaking to me. First, I don't actually think of myself as a particularly optimistic person, in general. However, when the pandemic struck us, I really had a certain hope that was based in what I know about human behavior. And, there's a lot of evidence that something like a tragedy, a crisis can really bring people together. And so I thought that, this would serve to do that. And, actually you did see some of that at the beginning of the pandemic. You saw lots of, really heartwarming images of and videos of people helping each other. You saw actually totally bipartisan support for the vaccine. And I guess I naively thought was going to stick around. So what was most surprising for me was when that really shifted over time, when you saw all of these in-group, out-group dynamics emerging. Mm. And in many ways, I shouldn't have been surprised based on what we know from social psychology. But I think, and to your point, this misinformation spreading like wildfire, just just really taking over social media and so many people dying as a result. I just, you know, found that so tragic. So I think that when I think about what did I learn about human behavior, I think it was really this, that it's not a, a crisis not only brings people together, but also divides people over time, and that it's not one or the other of these things, but actually both, and that the dynamics can really change over time. That is sort of what I learned.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's, I feel you.
And I don't particularly know what to do about it at this point. Right. I feel like I've, some of that initial hope that I felt, I don't feel so much anymore. And it seems like the strategies that public health and you know, communicators are using or haven't been particularly effective at you know, encouraging uptake of the vaccine among the anyone who is hesitant or you know, there are barriers in their way. And you know, life keeps throwing wrenches at us. We keep getting new variants that are that are complicating things. So you know, and making the vaccine that much more important.
Yeah, obviously goes back to J. Van Bavel as well, with you know, in-group, out-group, social dynamics, and how that's been interesting in the last, especially couple of years with this. Yeah,
absolutely. And don't forget about Dan Ariely, who himself was the victim, not was, but is still the victim of these COVID deniers. I mean, that is just a crazy situation. Oh,
I can't empathize with it in terms of like, it's just so unbelievable to have that happen. Like, it seems like a dystopian sci-fi plot. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it does. Well, speaking of dystopia, I have an interesting question for you.
Sure.
Thinking about your life as a whole, just imagine that you had to choose between your life being happy or, you know, being meaningful or being interesting. Which of these three would you go with if you had to choose? You don't have to choose in real life, of course, but let's say you you're given these three options.
There are three doors, only one that I can
work through.
Well, so for me, I don't know how much I've talked about this on the podcast or anything, but I've had my personal ups and downs in terms of I had some injuries and some chronic pain at some point as well. And going through some of those parts in terms of thinking about life as a whole, where you have, you know, life has its up and downs, right? And what is the thing that makes you get through it and makes you feel good about it and so on. And for me, my personal story has definitely been to reframe things as well. I only have one life. And so at least I want to live a life where I get a taste of a lot of variety, a lot of things in life.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like even with shitty things happening, I can at least say, well, I've got a taste of something in life that maybe other people haven't, or like that I wouldn't have otherwise. And now I've seen another side of life that I didn't before. And obviously going through some chronic pain stuff and injuries, it's, you know, you do see the world differently. And I do appreciate having more ability to understand people with different disabilities or other things like that when you personally go through things like that. So long winded way to say that I would go for interesting. Interesting. Yeah. For me, is having a sense of variety. You know, you sent me this really great article or research paper on this, and they list across these different things, they list what are key frames or kind of facilitators. And within the, I think what they define as a psychologically rich life, talk about variety, perspective change, curiosity, spontaneity, wisdom. So that's really, for me, what is important.
You've really done your homework here.
I have. No, this really resonated with me, actually. So I don't think I resonate as much with the more kind of, what do you call that? The more happy life.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? The happiness is what most people choose. The vast majority of people, when they, you know, are given this exact question, would say that they'd go for the happy life. And then number two is the meaningful life. And then you have this small subset of people, 7 to 17% or so, that actually prefer this interesting life. And I actually fall into this bucket as well. I think, you know, it's something that just appeals to me in terms of just understanding different people's perspectives and having the more nuance in life and experiencing lots of different things and having variety. I think all of this is really appealing to me, and it's part of the reason that I really like to travel, when that's an option. Just seeing the world and taking everything in, I think it's so important. And yeah, so I too was really excited to learn about this research coming from Erin Westgate and her colleagues. And I think that what they're adding this dimension of, psychological richness to the literature is really important, because historically the field of behavioral science has really thought about, this dichotomy in terms of, what can life be? Well, it can be happy. You have this sort of hedonic side, or it can be meaningful. You have the eudaimonic side. Well, it turns out there's a small subset of people who also find this third dimension of interestingness or psychological richness also very important. And so I think this really adds to that conversation that I personally, maybe you would agree, I felt like it was kind of missing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I think that this was an artificial exercise of which would you prefer. Everyone has some combination of all three.
Yeah.
And so it's a fun exercise, but it's definitely not the real version. But one thing I think that is interesting to think about is if you, and this is almost a nature nurture conversation, do you have a preference for one over the other initially, and that sort of shapes what kinds of experiences you seek out? Or is it, the circumstances that you're in and your environment and the things that happen to you and your experiences, does that then determine what your preference is? Do you, if you have been exposed to a lot of variety in your life, for example, do you then prioritize variety over, meaningfulness mm-hmm. and happiness? I think probably there's a little truth to both. as with all things, it's both and it depends.
So I'm going to spin this question. If you had to remove one of these and you wouldn't get any part of this type of life, which one would you remove of these three? A happy life, a meaningful life, or a psychologically rich life?
I would say definitely go with meaningful. I think
isn't it overrated? Meaningful? Isn't it overrated?
I think it is. I've never really felt like I have much meaning in my life. In my life. And, as an atheist, I think that's probably a big part of it. I don't have the spiritual side. I don't think there's, someone watching over me or caring about what I do. I think the universe exists for no reason. So maybe that's a little dark, but yeah, I don't think meaningfulness is particularly important to me. I would happily get rid of it already.
Same. Yeah. And I get very little in terms of part of my good life. I get very little of that from any type of significance or recognition. If anything, I feel like adds stress to my life to feel like, people who don't know me in some way, or whatever significance you could attribute to career or something like that. I think for me, it's more of a hindrance to a good life for me than a kind of something that adds to it.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but
yeah. Honestly, yeah, no, I think I chose the wrong thing to have a podcast here and talk about, but I enjoyed these conversations. Like I do enjoy that, but I less enjoy. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Sense of significance or purpose or these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we're on the same page. Cool. All right. What's next?
Well, so from one big question to another, let's talk about how behavioral science can be improved, or the world could be improved with behavioral science. Maybe there can be two sides of this coin. So I want to ask you, Aline, where do you think the biggest opportunities for improvement lies in terms of where applied behavioral science currently functions?
Yeah. So I think this is something I maybe say all the time. So I could just be repeating myself, but I think there's such a big gap in between what behavioral scientists are doing and then what's actually being implemented at a grand scale in the world. I just think that we do so much talking to ourselves and not enough talking to the people who are actually making decisions, the people who matter. And I think we have to find ways of having better and more influence on those decision makers. So the people who are in governments, people who are doing public policy and also those the people who are making the most popular products that everyone in the world uses. So the, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, and so on, the CEOs of companies, we need to get in their heads. We need to, you know, be talking to presidents of nations, you know, or maybe not even just talking to them. We need to become the presidents and the CEOs. We really need to do like this. This integration has to happen. Stop talking to ourselves and like get it done.
I love that. And some backstory here as well is that, so this goes back a little bit to our last episode with Lindsay, where you kind of had the suggested list you sent me of questions, and I read through them and they were like, does anything we do have a difference? all of these questions.
Do we matter at all? Yeah. No, I had a little bit of an existential crisis recently. That's what this is getting at.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's a great thing to talk about, because I do think, you know, we have mentioned a little bit before with the pandemic that we feel like, well, have we made any difference at all in the pandemic for good? Like, have behavioral science, can behavioral science say that, hey, well, we actually made this difference? Can we say that? I don't know. Like, there's been some good initiatives here and there.
Yeah.
But we've been quite invisible. Yeah, small ones. And even some very good initiatives that's been like innovative, high, big scale experiments hasn't really made much difference as well for whatever reasons. Mm-hmm. And so it is somewhat of a valid question, right? It's kind of, it's good to ask. And I'm reminded of this quote from you talking about, we got to get into the heads of the CEOs and so on. I'm reminded of this quote recently by Jack Dorsey, who just stepped down as CEO for Twitter, where he was asked, kind of like, what is one of your bigger regrets from early days of Twitter? Like, what do you wish you had or did differently? And one thing he mentioned is that he regrets not hiring experts to help him understand the potentially far-fetching importance of apparently small design choices. And that's what we do, right? That's what we can help with.
The job. That's the job description. Yep.
And so for whatever Twitters of the world that are starting now, wouldn't it be amazing if more behavioral science were there to kind of help make sure that, first of all, they led to a lot of positive and a lot of good things, but also maybe reduce the risks of these unintended consequences and these things happening within social media today and in other domains as well, where it just feels like a lot of startups, a lot of big enterprises just come about where people are like, oh, this is exciting. We're going to solve a problem. We're going to kind of do this cool tech solution, and not really thinking about it from a behavioral science perspective of like, what could you have for consequences?
Yeah, it's still very much an afterthought. It seems like when something goes wrong, that is often the point at which people are like, oh, our users are humans. What do humans do? Should we think about that? And I think that's when it's too late at that point. You know, you can still do something, but you're not going to have the same kind of impact that you can if you just design it for humans from the start.
Yeah, I'm Raina. When I was at Behavior Lab, which is the first Swedish behavioral consultancy, we joked about that very often. The reason why people came to us to get our help was that, like, hey, we've built this thing, like we have built this whole neighborhood and this whole road, but people are not doing what they're supposed to do, and it creates a lot of crashes, or people are not using the bikes or whatever they want to do. Could you use some nudge to get that to happen? Like, could you? We've done everything. Like, we've built everything. Everything is there. But could you add a nudge to change everything, like how they behave? And like you say, that's definitely a theme. But also sympathize. Like, I'm often in discussions, sometimes early stage startups where they have very low capital. They're like, what should we do? We have X much money. Developers are very costly. These things are very costly. We need developers. We need this. We need that. Do we really need a behavioral scientist? Is that really important? So I also sympathize in very early stages. It can be not obvious to think about that this is going to really benefit us. So I think as a field, we need to do better as well to show why and provide better cases for why behavioral science is useful at, let's say, a product level, or you mentioned policy level as well. So yeah, we can do better.
I agree. So, and what do you think? What's your answer to this question in terms of what's the biggest opportunity for improvement? How would you change behavioral science?
So for me, I think a lot about this gap between, you know, theory and practice, or academia and applied side. And I think for some people, they see it as like almost like a non-existing gap in some ways, if they're naive, if they'd actually been part of going from one to the other, or, you know, they usually realize that actually, wow, this is actually much wider gap than I thought it was. And this is actually quite of a cumbersome thing to overcome to mm-hmm. go from one to the other, for example. And it seems silly to me that we still provide quite little avenues of helping people to get into a good state of being a applied behavioral scientist. I think there's some been amazing initiatives. We have, you know, Action Design Network. We have obviously have weekly trying to do similar things. There's GABS, there's ABSA. There are definitely initiatives that are trying to create resources for applied behavioral scientists. But, you know, that's where I think we can do much better, is to kind of help people to understand, okay, I know there's a lot of people who want to be really good behavioral designers or applied behavioral scientists, but they're like, where should I work in an organization? How should I convince someone to hire me? How should I fit into a product team? What is actually the model or framework that I should follow? Like, there's so many unknowns that makes it really, what do you call it? Like learned helplessness. Like, you can easily feel like, I don't know which steps to take. Like,
yeah. It's such a, what is the path? Where are the resources? Yeah, no, it's true. And I think there are lots of resources out there. They're just not distributed in a way that makes them obviously available. So, like, for example, Zarak Khan has this book that he put together recently about building behavioral science within organizations that I think is a fantastic resource, and I recommend it to everyone. If anyone hasn't checked it out already, it's a really great compilation. But
it's free.
It's free. Yeah. I think there are so many things out there, but they're not like on one website. there isn't like the How to Become a Behavioral Scientist website. Maybe we should put this together, Sam. Maybe we should collect all these resources.
Maybe I'm already in the process of
you're already doing one step ahead of me as usual.
I was going to talk to you about this off air, but yes, we should.
All right.
We're going to do it. We can sign.
Okay. Yeah. You are signed up already. Good. This is the auto enroll version of my life.
Yeah. So one thing more I would like to mention in terms of how we can do better with behavioral science and how behavioral science can do the better as well is something that I'm very passionate about, which is effective altruism. And do you know about effective
altruism?
Let's
start with the definition. Yeah. I'm familiar, but let's get it out there for our listeners.
Sure. So a definition would be that effective altruism is this, call it like a community where the shared view is that we should focus on doing good in the world. So seeing how we can make the world better, but doing in that in the best way possible. So that it's great to be altruistic. So it's great to follow your heart in some ways. But we also know, especially if we're behavioral scientists, that maybe that can lead to people doing things that are actually not that good for the world. That actually makes people feel good about themselves, but actually might make the world worse. It might make, you know, problems more problematic and not solved. And so we should use this empirical and research-oriented way to solve important problems. And so it's very simple. It's kind of like very obvious for most people probably listening to this, that it's kind of like, that makes sense. and there's some great resources in terms of from 80,000 hours, helping people to create impactful careers, to Give Well, that tries to help people make better donations, and the list goes on. For me, I got introduced from a behavioral scientist, Peter Slattery, when I was living in Sydney, introduced me to this. And it's been a fantastic community. And I think a lot about, you know, based on being in that community as well, how we can do good using behavioral science. And one of the main things within effective altruism is think about, okay, what are the main kind of cost areas that I could do good in? Like, if there's so much of my time that so much of my resource I can spend, what should I spend it on? Like, what should I try to do to make the world better? Mm-hmm. And some of the two very common one is, you know, alleviating global poverty, which also Lisa Feldman Barrett mentioned in the podcast in this year, where she spoke a little bit about how important it is for obviously kids to be not malnourished. If they have proper nutrition, they grow up to become much more smart, capable human beings. And so that's a big one. Another one, probably quite interesting one, is global catastrophic risks. So thinking about how we can avoid AI taking over the world, nuclear war, pandemics, and so on.
AI is not going to take over the world.
Well, depends how you define that, but it's not so much that a one kind of this conscious AI will take over the world, but AI could very soon take over a lot of the games we play in the world, where if we define game as right now, we think about it as like an AI being better at us as chess. That is already happening, obviously. But then you think about the stock market is a game with rules and players. And we're already seeing that stock markets are more and more governed by AIs and trading algorithms. And it's very soon you can imagine that someone could better create an AI that, for example, just stocks a lot of money and takes it away from things and distribute in a poor way. Or like there could be a lot of terrible things happening through AI. And so it's a good thing to focus on.
Okay. I see that. So taking the problems that we of our systems that have already been established and exacerbating them by scaling them up, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much. So This is all to say, I just want to mention that there's actually a community of behavioral scientists within the EA kind of space. So there's a newsletter on this. There's a Slack community on this. So I'll share a link on this. And if anyone is interested to kind of better understand how, you know, there's some interesting research coming out on the psychology of effective giving and effective altruism, how effective altruism can help psychologists and behavioral scientists maximize their impact, what works to increase something like charitable donations and so on. There's a lot of interesting things for how to do good when it comes to both the research and applied side of it. And I think that's something where, you know, they can be much more done. I think behavioral scientists talking about doing good, I think within EA, there's a lot of opportunities to do good. So, okay, I'm going to just say that I'm affiliated with EA, but this is a voluntary
disclaimer.
Yeah. I want to take this opportunity to really like beat your drum of EA and hopefully get some great people to help do some good things.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Sounds very cool. And honestly, it really ties into a topic that we wanted to talk about, which is ethics in behavioral science. And I think that, you know, to your point, if you have this goal in mind of, you know, making the world a better place, and that everything kind of ties back into that, you know, primary mission, that seems like one way of really encouraging and facilitating more ethical behavioral science. Is that kind of how you think of ethics as well?
Yeah. I would say that's probably quite close to why I think about it. And I think it's a tricky one though with ethics. We have talked a little bit about it. We had an episode with, was it Prince and Matt, where we talked a lot about marketing ethics? And,
we did, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And it's definitely not, I think, as straightforward as it would be nice if it was. It's much more complex than kind of setting these black and white boundaries between what is right and what is wrong to do. But yeah, you want to talk about this. I'm actually curious, how do you think about ethics in behavioral science right now?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, if it were as simple as everyone have the goal of making the world a better place and just remember that, I think that would be a really wonderful, easy like place to be. But I think, unfortunately, people are incentivized to, you know, find significant results, publish research in academia. And even if you're not in academia, you know, if you're working as an applied behavioral scientist in a company, you still want to show your value. You have to show that what you're doing is worth something, or no one's going to call you up. You have to show that you're fixing problems, you're designing interventions that are effective. And so there's all kinds of reasons that you would fudge the numbers or start p-hacking or you know, overstate your findings. And I think that it's a really interesting problem to think about. How do we do this in both of these realms? And I think that there's got to be a different solution in academia than there is in industry. There's so many cultural differences and just like ways of operating. Looking, you know, thinking back to your point about how you can't just really jump from one side to the other. There's all sorts of, you know, complications in that in terms of the culture and expectations and how things are done. And even like, will someone accept you in academia if you're coming from industry and vice versa? It's really not that straightforward. It's not like you can, hop from one to the other.
But I'm curious for you, can I ask you this? So my perception is you're more in academia than I am, for sure. And so my perception is that there's become much, much, much better systems for ensuring, you know, less p-hacking, less, you know, unethical setups for studies, pre-registering. And there's a lot of these different things that's come into place in the last, feels like a decade almost. Like it hasn't mm-hmm. been that much of time where a lot of things have changed in how, you know, both studies are set up, how they're managed and data-wise and everything. There's so many things that's happened within academia recently to reduce some of these ethical concerns. Do you think that's true? And if you do, is there anything from more of a system perspective that the applied side can learn from these recent changes or somewhat recent? Yeah.
I think so. Well, to your first question, is this working in academia? And a lot of what you're referring to is, I think, the open science movement. So just being more transparent with what's your experimental design? What analyses are you going to run exactly? You know, like to the specific regression that you're going to use, and so on. So there's no kind of, you know, deciding after the fact what counts as an outlier, which p-values are you going to report in your paper. And I think all of this is really, so I think that the general concept here is applicable in both domains for sure, that if you have a plan and you stick to it, your work is going to be more honest. And I don't know that you necessarily have to pre-register all of your studies, you know, on the OSF or you know, have a preprint of your paper. I certainly think that that's helping within academia, where the goal is to publish often. It's less focused on the impact that you're making. But I think that there are some other solutions within industry on top of, you know, having a plan and sticking to it. I think there are some other things that can be helpful. And I think that one way of doing this is not putting so much weight on one particular experiment. So if you know, if you've put all of your eggs into your one basket and you're saying, this is the, you know, big study that I'm going to run this year, you're investing everything into that one thing, you're very, very motivated for that to not fail, for your hypothesis to be shown in your results. And I think if you can set up your research environment within the organization that you're in to run many smaller studies, you can, you're sort of making lots of smaller bets, and you can point to any one of those succeeding, or, you know, succeeding in the sense that you find the results that you wanted. You can say that there's success even in your failures. And, you know, there's lots to say about that as well. But I think that in general, experimenting more and testing a lot, you're sort of placing your bets on the process rather than one particular idea, that is gonna hedge some of that risk and make you more honest overall. I see lots of less effective strategies out there. I see lots of companies making ethics boards, which feels a lot to me like lip service, you know, you have an ethics statement, and, you know, the people who are really passionate about ethics are going to live by that, whether or not there's an ethics statement. And then the people who are not motivated in those terms are going to do whatever they want anyway. So it feels a little bit like preaching to the choir when you send out a statement or say like, these are our ethical principles at organization X. So I don't find that to be a very effective strategy.
Wait, you're not impressed by Facebook's ethics board that they've set up?
Yeah. Facebook, the most ethical organization out there.
They have a lot of leading scientists based in like 12 countries that are on this ethics boards.
Yes. Yeah. Impressive.
I agree with you. And I was going to say, somewhat related to this is what I hope for in the future, like now think a little bit ahead, is in general for the perception and focus of our field, both in terms of how we talk about it, but also how people get interested in it, is more about understanding the process of applying behavioral science than just leaning too much on whatever has been in the last decade of nudging and gamification, where it's like the focus is on the intervention end to it. Obviously, that's always going to be a thing that's going to catch a lot of eyes. Like, hey, look, this small change made this big difference. Like, obviously, that's fun to learn about. But I hope that it's also going to be the case where people understand that it's not that simple, and they want to be more curious about, okay, I want to achieve good results, but I realized I have to understand the process for achieving them in order to achieve them. And we become a little bit better at communicating that. And also that interest follows a little bit. That's my hope. Talking about being a little bit hopeful, that's my hope, is to kind of get people a lot excited for the process of applying behavioral science rather than the final nudges that could be cool to talk about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yay. Okay. Well, are we at overrated versus underrated?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
I had to Google what happened in 2021 in order to put together this our underrated, overrated for today.
Yeah. So how we've set it up is that I don't know what Aline has on her in front of her. She doesn't know what I have. And we're going to ask each other, you know, four overrated, underrated each based on some trends and news in 2021. So kind of hindsight 2021, what has been overrated versus underrated? Is that a good introduction?
I love it. Can I go first?
Okay, sure.
Freeing Britney.
That's surprisingly hard to rate.
Is it?
So I will be honest in that my sisters have been obsessed about this. I have three older sisters.
My sister as well. This question came from her. This is a dedication to Ava, my darling younger sister, my favorite sister.
So for about 10 months of this year, I've been standing on the outside, kind of rolling my eyes and being like, well, this is overdramatized. It's more like she's okay. It's fine. I don't know too much about her, but it seems like they're making a lot of this assumption about like conspiracy thing. Like they're reading how she blinked in an interview and how she, you know, like they feel like a lot of that stuff. Then my sister made me watch this documentary a month ago. And now I've just flipped over to the other side where I'm like excited to freeing her and seeming that she's been freed. Is that the latest?
She has been freed. Yes. Her conservatorship has ended. She is now a free woman.
Okay. Good news for the world in a small way. Yeah. Underrated.
Wonderful.
Okay. My first one for you, given that I know you travel quite a bit, my one is traveling locally. So kind of having like this home or staycation of sort, not so much in your home, but in your local area or neighborhood, overrated or underrated?
That's very interesting. I'm tempted to say both. My inclination was first underrated because I think there are so many wonderful things in your immediate vicinity that aren't explored and you should do that. But on the other hand, I think it's so sad when people don't get out farther. You know, I've met so many people who are like, I've never left the state of, you know, whatever. And that I think is tragic. So I think, you know, I'm still going to go with underrated because I've had so many lovely experiences just going to the North Carolina mountains or the lake that's, you know, 15 minutes from my house, or even honestly, camping in my backyard was a hoot.
Wow.
Yeah, I did that.
In a tent? Like in what way?
Yes. In a tent. In a tent. This was last
pre-baby
year.
Pre-baby or post-baby? Yeah.
It was pre-baby. Okay. Although we talked about maybe we should do it post-baby. Why not? I think he'd love it.
That's cool. That's cool. Side note, what are you most looking forward to visiting outside of the US when you get a chance to travel? What destination?
So the first place I'm most excited to travel to is Switzerland, which is a boring response. I'm also very excited to go to Sweden, but I don't have any relatives in Sweden. I'm excited to see my Grossi, who is turning 90 very soon. Yeah. Wow. I have lots of relatives in Switzerland. My dad is Swiss. So I'm excited to go there. That's my boring answer. And then my more exciting answer is, I don't know, Antarctica, like, who knows? There are so many places that I still have on my list. I have globes and maps all over my house with little pins in them of places I've been and places I want to go. And before the pandemic hit, we decided that we were going to go to a place starting with B. So so that's been postponed, but we're either going to Brazil, Bermuda, Barbados. I'm not sure what it is, but it's going to be something starting with a B.
Nice. Well, maybe, you know, we can do this thing where as podcasts become more successful to do this like tours, they do like live recordings. you know, maybe 2022 we'll do live recording in a city close to you.
Oh yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Quitting your job.
That's been a big trend. Yeah, underrated. Underrated. I think, you know, I'm very much someone that's trying to evangelize the idea of like, love the idea of having a little more freedom to explore things and find kind of this niche of what serves you. And I'm going to quit my job and then do this thing that really suits me well and figure out that thing. But I also remember that's like romanticizing something that's kind of hard to get to. So
No, and certainly this has been in the news a lot, as a lot of people are resigning and either finding new jobs or not finding new jobs. Mm. So I think it's really interesting to see how people are rethinking their careers and also how employers are responding to, you know, what they're calling the great resignation.
That's right.
Hopefully putting some pressure to make some important changes in terms of, you know, workplace well-being, you know, supporting different kinds of flexible work and so on.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see what happens next. How much of this kind of freedom for people to work flexibly in whatever way they prefer will continue to kind of be a trend. I look forward to seeing it. Next one for you. Mandates. Overrated or underrated?
Interesting. Underrated. I'm
more vaccine passports.
Yeah, I was a fan of the vaccine passport from the beginning. And I think if it were implemented earlier on, I believe there would have been less resistance because you wouldn't have had as much polarization and this these echo chambers really sort of fueling this separation, all of these divisions. I think if you could have gotten ahead of that and just said, all right, this is what we're doing, and, you know, framed it in a way that everyone accepts, I think we would be in a much happier place right now. So I'm for it.
Okay. Okay.
Were you expecting that?
Paternalism all the way.
Yeah. Well, you know, like Lindsay said, yes. I'm a behavioral scientist, so I'm a fan of paternalism. Love it. On that same theme, the COVID-19 vaccine.
Wow.
That was this year.
That was this year.
Yeah.
So this might be a cliche answer, but it was underrated for the reason that it's an incredible technologically. Like, if that's something that I've been so impressed by, how the vaccine rollout has been. And I look at a country like Portugal, for example. Do you know that Portugal has 92% vaccine distribution of the population? Like, it's like insane how good job they've done.
Very impressive. Yeah.
Spain and Portugal has done a great job. And so I am both very thankful for the vaccine. I'm very thankful for how well it's been distributed in some places and how hopefully, you know, hard to measure these things, but hope, you know, it's saved a lot of lives. And it's been, you know, a gift in 2021. Yeah.
Yeah. It's unbelievable to me, truly, that we don't have 100% consensus on the underratedness of the vaccine. I think it's just an incredible, incredible invention.
Okay. Going from one dystopian discussion to another, joking. Metaverse.
So Meta is the new name of Facebook. Is anything changing other than the name? I feel uninformed.
I can update a little bit here. Yeah. So
okay.
Facebook has changed name. So their parent holding company has changed from Facebook to Meta, and similarly how Google changed the name to Alphabet before. Uh-huh. Yeah. It doesn't really change anything within Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp. They're still kind of going forward as usual. But when they announced this, they did a lot of PR to say that this is an exciting change because in the future, Meta will provide you with a metaverse. It will provide you with this, you know, there was a lot of interesting videos with either interviews where Zac Efron, I was going to say, but that's not his name. Zac Efron is not the CEO of Facebook.
No, he's not. He might look a little bit like Zac Efron.
No, Zuckerberg.
I see.
Yeah. So some weird interviews with Mark Zuckerberg in some ski cabin, and there's been some weird videos of people going to like music concerts and going through some weird jungle exploration. So they're trying to at least convince the public that this is what's coming next, a metaverse run through Meta or Facebook. So that's the context.
I would say highly overrated. I do not trust this scenario. If anyone is going to make my universe, if it's going to be any of the big companies, I hope it's not Meta. I understand that technology is taking over and there's nothing we can do about it. But in terms of the good actors and the less good actors out there, I think there are better actors than Mark Zuckerberg. Amen. Zac Efron, for example, would be great. let him take over the world.
Yeah, it might be a little more focus on what do you call it, suntans, what do you call it, fake tans, and pull-ups.
Pull-ups? What's a pull-up? That's a like, diaper.
This clearly indicates a different context. A pull-up, I think about as a gym context pull-up,
you pull yourself up. I do know what a pull-up is.
But you're thinking about urine still, and obviously.
Yeah. I'm in baby land. Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah.
Last one. Uh-huh. Last one for me. Face masks with a clear plastic cutout over the mouth.
Has that become a thing? I saw some early.
Exists.
Yeah, it's okay. I think overrated. But full disclosure, I'm in Sweden and no one in Sweden is wearing masks.
Oh.
So I am honestly, full disclosure, not always wearing masks as well. I am wearing them in indoor settings. I try to, for the most part.
I will prove you wrong right now. You are currently indoors, not wearing a mask. I can see you. Liar.
Okay. Not when recording podcasts. caveat. No, but I would say they're very overrated. I don't know how much difference it would make to see someone smile that way. I don't know. I wear a mask and I kind of enjoy not having my face shown. Like I enjoy the privacy of having half of my face not shown.
That's a very Swedish thing to say.
Yeah. I have no need for people to see like the food I have stuck between my teeth you know, my poorly managed beard or something. Like, I kind of enjoy people just seeing my eyes now. Last one for you, having a baby in 2021.
Definitely underrated. Having a baby is fantastic. Not the actual birth part or the pregnancy leading up, like all those parts definitely skip if you can. But having a baby is amazing. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is so much fun. It is wonderful. It is exhausting. Fine. Mm. Whatever. You know, like, I don't know. Whatever.
Going back to our initial question there, what part of life has it improved? Like in terms of good life, has it made your life happier, more meaningful, more interesting?
I think it is both happier and more interesting. And I don't see how, I think a lot of people argue that babies bring meaning.
Yeah,
certainly that. Yeah, like that was the argument that my husband, full disclosure, that was what he said was like the benefit of having a baby when he was trying to persuade me that we should. And I never really saw that. It doesn't make logical sense to me. And I think it could be just like a funny quirk of who I am, because I think that's a very popular rationale. But I think just like the joy that Nico has brought me is so incredible. He's so in such a good mood all the time. He's just like finds everything amazing. And then you start to take his perspective and find everything amazing as well. And it's like, just like so much joy all the time. And then interesting, like he does weird stuff. It's really interesting to just see like, oh, like this is how like, you know, a human being learns to chew and to eat and to like do all these kinds of things on its own. It's just like so incredible. It's the things that I've learned about human beings is just like really, really expansive from this experience. So yeah, definitely happy and interesting, not meaningful.
Have you learned anything about yourself as well? Like, has that been interesting to learn other sides of yourself, or are you not surprised at all by how you've yourself managed this new situation?
I think I've found that I'm more patient with the baby than I am in general. Yeah, I stop myself from getting upset in all situations with the baby, whereas I would like definitely not have that kind of self-control in other situations, which makes me think I could just have better self-control in general. If I can do it then, you know, why don't I do it more? But yeah, I think I've found that my ability to manage my emotions is better than I would have expected, certainly. Mm.
And one thing that might be worth mentioning, because when you describe this, it might sound that it's easy to have a baby. That's not what you're saying, right? That's not always been easy. It's been some really tough times, right?
Yes, it's very hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard and very fun, and definitely do it. That's my advice. And I'm also coming from a perspective where this is not something that I ever planned on. This is actually something that I really only changed my mind about during the pandemic. And yeah, I'm sure it's not for everyone. I think I also would have been a fine person if I didn't change my mind about this. But yeah, I think it's really wonderful.
And this might bring us to our final question of sort, where we usually ask our guests this season, what has been one thing they've changed their mind about? And, you know, it sounds like you've changed your mind about this. Is that your answer to this question? If so, or either way, I would be interesting to know why or how you ended up changing your mind. Was it a very persuasive partner, or what happened? Why did you change your mind?
I think, yes, I'll say this is definitely something that I've changed my mind about. And I think what happened was I just kind of looked at my life at the time, really like the pandemic changed everything for me in terms of my perspective and how I thought about work and life and friends and relationships and everything. And I just thought, you know, before I thought, I have all these projects, my time is fully booked. I wouldn't take on a new project right now because I'm so busy, and a baby is a very large project. Like the t-shirt size of baby is just large. Like there's no arguing with that. And even though they're so small, it's ironic. And so I was thinking about it in this very reasoned way. And that's like, you know, how I try to make decisions in general. But then when the pandemic happened, I really just thought, wait a minute, is like, are any of these things that I'm working on really that important? Before I thought it was yes. And then during the pandemic, I thought, look at all these essential workers who are actually doing important things, and people who are developing the mRNA vaccine, like that's important. People who are, you know, working in hospital, that's important. Like, I'm not really that important. I could have a baby. And so I just kind of did it, and I'm so much better for it. I think I'm a better person. It's the other thing that I find really ironic is that I thought of having a baby as a very boring thing to do that everyone does. And as you know, I really value psychological richness, interesting variety. Yeah. I don't need to do the thing that everyone else does. And I have found that through this experience, the thing that I thought was the most boring thing is actually the most exciting thing. It is so cool. Like creating a human being is just so incredible. Like I can't even take credit for it. It's just so amazing. I made a whole person. It's nuts.
This segment was sponsored by Pampers Diapers.
Pull-ups. Pull-ups for everyone. Pull-ups all around.
Special deal. Pampers.com/behave and you'll get 20% off from the next order of diapers.
I hope we never have ads. That's my hope for the podcast. Sam, what about you? What is something that you've changed your mind about?
So I have changed my mind about my neighborhood. So when I come back to Sweden, I became a very typical Swedish person in the sense that I've like by default just avoided getting to know my neighbors. Like there's this, you know, meme of sort or typical thing in Swedish films or TV shows where you will see someone leaving, like a neighbor leaving their apartment. And then you have another neighbor hearing this and are about to leave as well. And then wait for that person to kind of walk down the stairs. And once the hallway is clear, then they open the door as well, because they don't want to kind of rub shoulders in the elevator or going downstairs. Mm-hmm. And I think I follow a little bit of that type of attitude towards my neighbor and my neighborhood. But then in the last year, I've been stuck in Sweden. I've been stuck in Stockholm. And I realized that I have a really wonderful neighborhood with some fantastic people. Like I've got to know personally, I have a kiosk outside of where I live, run by Andreas, who's a really lovely man and his partner. I have a coffee shop around the corner run by Francesco. I have names to people in kind of this neighborhood. And it was funny when my sister came to visit this summer, I had randomly, after having bought a falafel from Andreas, mentioned that my sister was coming. And then I walked by with my sister and he's like, oh, he's like, calls her names like, hey, you must be oh, Sandra's sister. And she's like, how the heck does this guy know that I'm here? You know? And he gives popsicles to my niece and nephew and they get super excited. And then when they visited me again 1 week later, because I'm in a different town than my hometown, my niece and nephew was like, where's Andreas? We want to say hi to Andreas again. And I just love that feeling of like, even though technically very little between me and Andreas in common in terms of, you know, probably lead very different lives, but
maybe more than you think.
And I love feeling like I'm part of this neighborhood now more. And that's something that I wouldn't have guessed or predicted a year ago. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah. And if you're ever in Stockholm, I'm happy to show any listener around the neighborhood.
What about me? Can I also visit you in Stockholm?
Yes. No, I do hope that you take the wrong flight and you're accidentally going to Sweden instead of Switzerland and you come up to Stockholm with Nico and co and you can come here and I can show you all of the good Swedish nature and food and everything like that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. Pretty much the whole world gets Switzerland and Sweden mixed up anyway. So
that's right.
Like maybe the airlines will too.
Who knows? But let's wrap it up there maybe. You know, it's wild that we have had our first full year of this podcast. It feels like forever ago in some ways for me. I don't know how it feels for you. Does it feel like we did our first episode released? Our first episode released in January this year. Does it feel like that to you or does it feel like we've done it for a longer time?
Well, it's strange because it does feel like we've been doing this forever, but that also feels like the wrong answer. You know, you're
right.
Time flies when you're having fun. You're supposed to like, this has been a huge amount of fun for me. I feel like I can't even believe I get to do this as a job. It's just so incredible. So I've loved it so much. And so even though it feels like it's been a long time, I think that just speaks to the strength of our relationship and how much we've really experienced already in this time. You know, we've met so many cool people, and we've just packed it all into a pretty short amount of time. It's so cool.
It is really cool. And it's wild. I guess looking back at some of the guests, I think we both have had, you know, a guest that has been almost surreal to have talking with in some way, you know. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it was Wendy Wood. Feel like I'm reading a research forever. And then just having this really wonderful conversation with her was amazing. Was it Emily Oster for you?
Emily Oster was for sure my sort of dream guest. I was very excited when she joined us.
Yeah. And I think our goal has always been to bring in cool people, interesting people, but then try to have a casual, fun conversation and not be pretentious, not be kind of overly intellectual and trying to do it that way, but more just having fun as well, because we want to have fun doing this. We want to have fun recording and have interesting conversations for us personally. So, what has been your favorite part of hosting the podcast?
I mean, other than getting to meet the coolest people doing behavioral science in the world, I think just like the fun that we have has been, you know, just the fact that we chose to keep this kind of lighthearted and talk about random pop culture things, even though neither of us knows anything about pop culture. No. Like we're talking about TikTok and Tinder and I'm like, I've literally never used either. It's just like, I feel like it's a little bit irresponsible, but it's fun. I think we, you know, sometimes I know enough about pop culture to be dangerous, but I hope that I'm transparent enough about my lack of knowledge in some places. And then, you know, we do know quite a bit in other areas. So, yeah, I think we've taken what's already a very interesting topic of applied behavioral science and, you know, doing behavioral design and made it, if possible, even more fun.
Yes. No, I think we've done a pretty good job. We have, you know, I don't know if I should say this, but numbers are interesting sometimes. We've had 50,000 plays so far this year, as in played episodes in total. Almost 100 countries with listeners are based. I think it's like 90 or something, which is insane. I looked at the list and I'm like, I didn't know this was a country. And I know my countries pretty well. So that's been really cool. And in general, you know, it's not about that in terms of, as we both know, like 50,000 is just a number, but anytime someone mentions the podcast and says some good things, that feels so good. It really hits right at the heart. So thanks for everyone both listening and also saying nice things and sharing it. And we have had some really nice people giving really great ratings for the podcast. We've keep doing that if you want to. In general, it's been really fun to have conversation with people where they come up to me and they're like, hey, you know, I've listened to all of the episodes and having opinions about something we've said or, you know, just talking about it. I think it's really fun. I really enjoy it.
One of my favorite moments was a coworker came up to me and said, I love your podcast, but your answer was so wrong. to one of the underrated, overrated. It's just like, okay, let's fight about it.
Right. Yeah. So thanks to everyone listening. And thanks for everyone supporting the podcast. And personally, thank you, Aline. It's been really, really fun. Really enjoy these conversations with you. And it's kind of on my calendar. It's like, oh, something I look forward to. Like, oh, I can talk with Aline and have an excuse to talk about all things under the sun, behavioral science.
Same.
Awesome.
All right. Well, goodbye, everyone. Have a wonderful holiday and we'll see you for season 3.
Thank you for listening to the Behavioral Design Podcast from Have a Weekly and the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. The song used is Murgatroyd by the wonderful David Pissarro, and thanks to the team at Orange Wall Media for the production of this episode. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Obviously, we've said this all season, but if you like what we're cooking here, make sure to share with a friend, a colleague. We have now more than 30 episodes, all in our biased eyes, very, very good. So hopefully you can find one there to share. My personal favorite is probably one of either the one with Lisa Feldman Barrett, with Wendy Wood, or a very recent one called Element of Choice with Eric Johnson. Thanks again for listening to this episode. We'll be back again in the new year with many more deep dives into all things behavioral design. Until then, we wish you happy holidays and a wonderful end to 2021. See you in 2022.
Heavens to Murgatroyd. Oh.
Blow.
Oh.